Now, who's ever been on a flight, or maybe a bus, or traveling somewhere where you're not driving, and it's a little scary? Maybe turbulence on an airplane, or I can think of some bus rides we've been, different times where I'm slightly concerned about the bus driver and how quick they're going around these turns, or whatever the case may be. Has anybody ever been in one of these situations before? Maybe your spouse is driving? No, I don't know, but we've all probably been there at some point. Well, I heard a story recently of a man who often flew for business. He gets on the plane, they're going, things are normal. This little kid sitting next to him, as soon as she got in her seat, kind of crossed her legs, reading a book, kind of oblivious. And as the flight goes on, they start hitting some turbulence. And this man travels a lot, so at first it's not a big deal, but then it keeps getting worse, where the plane's kind of going up and down. And he finds himself kind of gripping the armrest of the chair. And he's getting a little nervous himself, even though he flies often. But he looks over, and this little girl is just reading her book. Not a care in the world, as if nothing is going on. And this goes on for another 10 minutes or so, and this man, you know, is nervous, as we probably would be in those situations, even if we know, you know, planes don't really crash, right? It's pretty, well, I guess I can't say that this year. Usually, planes don't crash until the last year. But still, the likelihood of a plane crash, right, is pretty infinitesimal. And so this man knows, you know, he's going to be fine, and yet there's nerves because the plane's bouncing and jumping. And finally it settles out, and as that goes on, they land, and he looks over at this little girl and says, you know, how are you so calm? You know, I fly all the time, and I was nervous. And she says, you know, my dad's the pilot. I knew he'd get us home safe, so why would I worry? And this man thought, well, that's interesting. He didn't know the pilot. He just got on the plane. And so if you don't know who's flying the plane, you can get a little nervous when things get bumpy. But this little girl knew her dad was flying and knew he'd get her home. So why would she be worried? You know, one way to put it is that her faith wasn't in the airplane. Her faith was in her dad, who she trusted would get her home safe. You know, our faith is an interesting thing. And it's only as strong as what we have our faith in. But our faith is only as strong as what our faith is in. There's things that we put faith in that aren't dependable, and it'd be a pretty useless faith. For this little girl, she had faith in her dad that he could get them home. And they could. Now, today we're going to look at faith and how we view that in relation to our view of God. There's three ways I want to look at it. One, we're going to look at it in view of faith in God's power, faith in God's wisdom, and faith in God's love. Three ways that we can have faith, or three areas of our faith that shape kind of how we view our relationship with God. Faith in his power, faith in his wisdom, and faith in his love. And as we'll see today, that really all three of those elements are important to move forward in our relationship with God. Because if we just have faith in one or two of those elements, it's not enough. We have to have an understanding of all three to truly have faith in who God is. You know, there's often words associated with those three words. Maybe you've heard the word omnipotent. It's kind of a very religious-sounding word, but it just means all-powerful. So we have faith that God is omnipotent or all-powerful. We have faith that God is omniscient, which really just means all-wise or all-knowing. And then the third thing, as we think about his love, is that we believe that God is omnibenevolent, means he's all-loving. That's who he is, that he's omnipotent, omniscient, and omnibenevolent. Again, those words really just mean all-powerful, all-knowing, all-loving. Omni means all, so then benevolent means love. You know, potent power. Omniscient means wise or understanding. So just fancy words to say God is all-powerful, all-knowing, and all-loving. But the question is, do we truly believe that? Do we truly have faith that all three of those elements are true? Because there's times in our life where maybe we'll say, God, I know you have all the power, so why didn't you stop this? Or why did you allow this? I know my faith is in your power, but maybe we're struggling with faith in his wisdom or faith in his love. Or other times it may come in a different way. So as we think about that today, we're going to look at these three elements and see what the Bible has to say about God's power, God's wisdom, and God's love, and see how that really directly affects our faith in who he is, what he does, and how we view him. So as we begin, we're just going to look at the first one, probably the most obvious. We view God as omnipotent, that he truly is all-powerful. His power is truly limitless. You know, that's what the Bible tells us. We truly believe that God is all-powerful, and we have to believe there's nothing beyond what he can do. It's easy to say yes to that kind of just on the surface, but it gets harder at times as we go through the concepts of what that means in our day-to-day life. Because when we think about it, the Bible is full of stories that demonstrate God's power. From huge global events, things like worldwide floods, or parting a Red Sea, or parting the Jordan. Right? Things that we can just read over in a Bible story without recognizing, you know, this takes an amount of power that's beyond our comprehension at times. Right? That God moved the earth backwards in its rotation at times, right? To demonstrate his power. We can read that and say, you know, that's pretty cool. But we don't grasp that that's, you know, demonstrating his limitless power. But it demonstrates that God's power is kind of unmeasurable. And so we look at these big events, like he created the universe, the heavens, the earth, created mankind, right? We can look at it from a big global scale to recognize God's power. And there's verses that remind us of that. We'll just look at two quick ones. Go with me over to Isaiah for a moment. Isaiah 46 and verses 9 and 10. We'll look at this groundwork a little bit and then go into something a little bit deeper. Isaiah 46, verses 9 and 10. Isaiah writes, "Remember the former things of old, for I am God and there is no other. I am God and there is none like me, declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times things that are not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand and I will do all my pleasures." We'll stop there, but after that he starts showing how he's going to prophesy that this man Cyrus is going to show up hundreds of years later, and he calls him by name and saying he's going to bring my people back to Jerusalem. So he's saying this to demonstrate that he can make stuff happen hundreds of years in the future. And he uses the phrase, sorry, I lost my spot here, declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times things that are not yet done. He's showing that he says things are going to happen that even haven't happened yet, and he can say it dogmatically, because his power will make it happen. He says it a little bit even stronger in the book of Romans. Go with me to Romans 4, verse 17. Romans 4, 17. I know we could spend an hour going through the verses that just talk about God's power, but I just want these two to kind of segue in to where we're going to take this. Romans 4:17. He says, "As it is written, I have made you a father of many nations in the presence of him who he believed, God, who gives life to the dead and calls those things which do not exist as though they did." And that's an important phrase as we think about God's power. He says he can proclaim something as if it's already existing, even if it doesn't. Because in his power, he knows he's going to make it happen. So he doesn't say, you know, I think in the future I might be able to swing this so that, you know, Abraham, you become this big nation. No, he says, Abraham, you're going to have this descendants, and they're going to have these nations, and this is going to happen. And he says it as if it's already happened, even before it did, because he says, I'm going to bring it to pass. So he demonstrates his power, that he can say things are going to happen in the future as if they've already happened. But it demonstrates his power to do whatever he chooses. But what I find interesting when we talk about the power of God, though, that he doesn't reserve it for just huge events. Like, God's power is demonstrated not just in controlling the world. We'll see as we go through the book of Daniel in a minute. But it's also on the personal level, that God controls things in our lives. That his power isn't just reserved for global events, but also in the day-to-day lives of us, of mankind. One example of that is over in the book of Genesis. We'll go to Daniel next, but go with me to Genesis 18 and verse 14. We'll see that God uses his power in a very personal way here for Abraham and his wife Sarah. Genesis 18, we'll begin in verse 13. So remember, Abraham and Sarah have been told they're going to have this child, and they keep waiting, and they keep waiting. And Abraham and Sarah are old, beyond when people can have children. And so God comes and visits again and says, okay, now you're going to have a child. And in verse 13 it says, and the Lord says to Abraham, why did Sarah laugh, saying, shall I surely bear a child, since I am old? And then God continues, is anything too hard for the Lord? He asks a simple statement that we can just gloss over. He says, is anything too hard for me? Sarah laughs because she thinks, you know, I'm too old to have a kid, so this isn't going to happen. It's almost a rhetorical question, but I think a question we have to sometimes stop and ask ourselves. Is anything too hard for God? And this isn't in the scheme of global powers and turning the earth. This is helping someone to get pregnant who wants a child. And God says, is anything too hard for me? And I love this story because it reminds us that God uses his infinite power on a very personal level. It reminds us of God's care and concern for us, and that power is used to intervene in our lives, probably more than we realize at times. And as our kids are growing, I pray about God using that power to intervene in my kids' life more and more in ways that maybe I'll never see, they'll never see. But we want God's power to intervene in a personal way. And that's where the book of Daniel kind of brings it all together. Go with me to Daniel chapter 3. What I love about the book of Daniel is that it kind of mixes God's global power with his very personal power. Right, a large portion of Bible prophecy is found in the book of Daniel, where God inspires history of kingdoms that are going to come and rule the earth that don't even exist yet. And he's saying, this is going to happen, right? Babylon's going to be here, and then Persia, and then Greece and Rome, hundreds of years before these nations had power. And so he's demonstrating his wisdom, his power, by saying what's going to happen globally. But mixed into these stories in Daniel, these prophecies, we see God intervene on a very personal level for Daniel multiple times, for his friends multiple times. We'll see it first here in Daniel 3 about these three guys, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, you've probably heard of. Right, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, where they're at, sets up this giant statue and says whenever this music plays, everybody has to worship the statue or they're going to be put to death. And these men, or I call them men, they're probably boys. Most estimates say these guys are probably 15, 16 years old. They grew up Jews in Jerusalem before they were taken captive to Babylon, and they know, no, we don't worship an idol. We only worship God. So they refuse to bow down. And King Nebuchadnezzar comes and says, you know, I'll give you one more chance before I throw you into this fire. Right? You've probably heard the story. I think it's one of the first stories that kids often hear. But what's interesting is, again, this story is in the middle of these giant prophecies. Chapter 2 that leads to this story is about these giant kingdoms that are going to show up on the earth and God saying what's going to happen. And then we see God reach down with his power to intervene on a personal level. And so these three men are brought before the king, and the king says, I'll give you one more chance. And notice how he ends this kind of chance to them in verse 15 of Daniel 3. So the king, talking to these men, he says, "Now if you're ready at the time to hear the sound of the horn, the flute, the harp, the lyre, the psaltery and symphony with all kinds of music, and you fall down and worship the image which I've made, good. But if you do not worship, you shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you from my hands?" Notice the real challenge. He doesn't say, you know, "I'm challenging you." Ultimately, Nebuchadnezzar says, "I'm challenging your God that he can deliver you from this. Who is the God who will deliver you from my hands?" And then the response comes in verse 16. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and say to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If that is the case, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace." So statement one is they say he has the power to deliver us. He is able. So they proclaim their trust in his omnipotence. He's all powerful. And then they say, "And he will deliver us from your hand, O king." We'll come back to that statement in a minute because it speaks to his ability to know what to do and their faith in that. So we say he's able to, and he will deliver us from you one way or another, essentially is what they say. And then verse 18, "But if not, let it be known to you, O king, we do not worship, so we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up." And we'll end the story there. We probably know, so he's angry, he throws them in, and then they're saved from the flames. The men throwing them in are killed, but they walk through the flames untouched. And just to demonstrate the power of God, you know, the pre-incarnate Jesus Christ seems to walk with them through the flames. They say they see four, one like the Son of God walking with them. For God to demonstrate a very personal demonstration of his power in this moment. And so again, what's interesting is that God doesn't reserve his unlimited power just for global events. Here he uses it to save someone from being thrown into the fire. He demonstrates that there's nothing beyond his power and his ability, and that he uses it to help his people in difficult times in their own life. And so their faith in God is questioned. The faith in their God's power is questioned. And the response is, God is able to save. And we put our faith in that. And they also leave room that God doesn't have to, right? They say, "And if not, we will be delivered by you, from you." And they probably viewed it as either God would deliver them like they did, or they were killed and they knew that that was a form of deliverance as well. You know, it's interesting when we think about it in our own life. You know, if I was in that scenario, if I was these men, my hope probably would be like, "Well, God, I know you can do this, so how about you wake him up before we get to the point of being thrown into the fire?" Right, in our own human life, we don't like to wait until that last second deliverance. For us, it's much more comfortable, "Well, God, why don't you just like make a little earthquake, you know, destroy the furnace, whatever you need to do, but let's not wait until I'm being thrown into the fire for you to show that power." And yet in God's wisdom and God's decision-making, that's sometimes where he leads us. What he allows to happen, we're thrown in the furnace, we're thrown in the lion's den, right? That story kind of copies later on in this book as well. That he waits until the last second, the last possible second for deliverance. And for us, no, we don't really like that. But if we think about it on the flip side, it also demonstrates God's power in a unique way. In a way that maybe we wouldn't notice or appreciate quite as much if it was done before. But if the story goes, you know, Nebuchadnezzar has a dream and he wakes up and realizes, "No, I shouldn't throw them in." You know, we probably read the story and still think it was fascinating, but I doubt there'd be as many kids' books written about this story. Right, we're drawn to it because of it's a last second save by God. Last second, God does something amazing. And the other thing side to think about too is that these men, if God would have allowed them to be killed, really this Bible story would have continued the same. Right? They don't show back up in the Bible. It's not like it would have changed God's whole plan, so he had to save them because he said, no, these three men are going to deliver Israel. And these three men, their descendants are going to do this or that. Right? We get stories of that with Abraham, Moses, David, where they had certain things that were prophesied that they had to fulfill. You know, if these men were killed, if God didn't reach down and deliver them, there would have just been a list of martyrs to say, look at these men's faith. And yet, even though it didn't alter God's story, he reached down with his power to save them because of his relationship with them. And I find that interesting as well, that it's not just in these giant altering moments that God chooses to reach down. He chooses to whenever he wants to. Another time we kind of see a similar story. Keep this in your mind as we go to the New Testament, the book of John. No, John chapter 11. We'll kind of see a similar thread here of wondering, why didn't God intervene sooner? John 11, we come to the story of the death of Lazarus. If you remember, Jesus had these three close friends, Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. Other than his disciples, they're probably ones talked about almost more than anybody else in the Gospels. Close friends of Jesus Christ. We find out that Lazarus is sick, and Jesus Christ doesn't seem too worried about it. He kind of seems to hesitate before he goes to help his friend. And people are probably not quite sure and understanding what's going on. But then we pick up in verse 14 of John 11, and we get a little insight of what's about to take place. So Jesus says to them plainly, Lazarus is dead. So this is after a few days. Lazarus is dead, and I'm glad for your sakes that I was not there, that you may believe. Nevertheless, let us go to him. Then notice Thomas's response. Then Thomas, who is called the twin, says to his fellow disciples, let us also go, that we may die with him. To me, it reminds me that they have no idea what's going on or what's about to go on. Right? They've been saying, you know, Lazarus is sick. And Jesus Christ says he's glad that he wasn't there. And they have to think, why? You could heal him. And then Thomas, I don't even understand really what he's trying to say here other than, he thinks, maybe this is the end. Maybe we're all going to die with Christ. You know, Thomas is kind of a unique character in the story of, you know, doubting Thomas as he comes up other times. Which I don't know if it's a very fair name to give him, but we see an interesting phrase from him. What it strikes to me is that they just don't understand what's going on or what's about to go on. And so the story continues. Jesus goes to where Lazarus was, where he died. And we pick up the story in verse 20. So Jesus shows up to this town. Now Martha, as soon as she heard that Jesus was coming, went and met him, but Mary was sitting in the house. Now Martha said to Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now I know that whatever you ask of God, God will give you. She almost contradicts herself here. She says, if you were here, we know you could have healed him. And then she kind of gives a little bit of, and we know God hears you, whatever you say. But it doesn't seem like she quite believes even that own statement of herself. Because Jesus says to her, your brother will rise again. And Martha says to him, I know that he'll rise again in the resurrection at the last day. And Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, though he may die, he shall live. And whoever lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? And she says to him, yes, Lord, I believe you are the Christ, the Son of God, who has come into the world. And so that kind of interaction ends with, I think, Martha probably not sure where to take it. But she proclaimed her faith in a resurrection the last day, that Christ will return and Lazarus will be raised. But Jesus is talking about something different. And we see this kind of repeated. In verse 28, as we continue, it says, and when she had said these things, she went her way and secretly called Mary, her sister, saying, the teacher has come and is calling for you. As soon as she heard that, she rose quickly and came to him. Now Jesus had not yet come into the town, but was in the place where Martha met him. Then the Jews who were with her in the house and comforting her, when they saw that Mary, rose up quickly and went out, followed her, saying, "She's going to the tomb to weep there." Then when Mary came to where Jesus was and saw him, she fell down at his feet, saying to him, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." And the same thing Martha said, right? Their trust is that God could heal. But that's where their faith in some ways seemed to stop. And that's why Christ said, "I'm going to show you something that they don't even expect." Because in their mind, if Christ had showed up, Lazarus would be healed, life would be good. But Jesus is demonstrating that his power doesn't stop at healing. He's going to demonstrate to them that his power doesn't stop, that death doesn't stop his power, that he can choose to resurrect. In some ways, they weren't quite viewing Jesus as omnipotent, right? Their idea was, well, if you were here sooner, this could have been fixed. But they're not saying, "You're here now, so why don't you resurrect him?" And it's an odd concept to us because even now, right, we pray for people's healing, but I don't think we've ever seen a prayer request, you know, "Well, they're dead, but let's keep praying for God's resurrection." Right? And it sounds counterintuitive for us to even think about because, in all fairness, right, that's not usually how God operates. We see very few examples of this, so I don't leave here with the idea that, well, God will resurrect whoever we're asking, right? That's not my point here. But my point is, our control or our view of how God's power operates is sometimes skewed from our human perspective. They had this physical perspective that if he was here sooner, he could have healed him. But now he's too late. Do we have a view that God is too late to fix our problems? It's kind of the reality of what they come to here. And so the story continues. Jesus says, "Where have you laid him?" And they say, "You know, it's been 4 days, so he's clearly dead, and he stinks, and you should not go in here." Right, that's where we come to in verse 38. Actually, let's go to verse 37, because we even see even the people around have the same concept. In verse 37, it says, "And some of them said, 'Could not this man who opened the eyes of the blind also have kept this man from dying?'" So even the other people around said, "We've seen his miracles. He could have helped this man if he was here before he died." That's where their power, their view of his power stops. So I'll pause here for 1 second. I just realized it's raining. I know it was like 95 degrees when you got here. So if your windows are down, you may want to go put your windows up or just share that with anybody. I'm pretty sure our windows are down, so that's more for my wife maybe more than anybody else. But no, I just happened to notice that. And so as we think about this, is this how we view God sometimes, that his power stops somewhere along this path? And so in verse 38 it says, "And Jesus, again groaning in himself, came to the tomb. It was a cave and the stone laid against it. And Jesus said, 'Take away the stone.' Martha, the sister of him who was dead, said to him, 'Lord, by this time there's a stench, for he's been dead 4 days.' And Jesus said to her, 'Did I not say to you that if you would believe, you would see the glory of God?' And they took away the stone from the place where the dead man was lying, and Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, 'Father, I thank you that you've heard me, and I know that you always hear me. But because of the people who are standing by, I said this, that they may believe that you sent me.' Now when he said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, 'Lazarus, come forth.' And he who died came out bound hand and foot with grave cloths on his face and wrapped with a cloth. And Jesus said to them, 'Loose him and let him go.'" We're in the story here, but I think it speaks to the concept of we fall into this trap of limiting God's power, maybe unknown to ourselves sometimes, right? They had this idea, and we're saying God could heal. If he was here, he would have healed him. And there's times in the ministry where Jesus Christ healed people without being there, right? He sent people away and they were healed. Or he said someone they'd be healed, and by the time they got back, the person was healed. So they'd seen all these miracles where someone reached out and just touched his clothes. So they knew he could heal. But their belief seemed to stop to an extent that that's where his power stopped. And the Bible is full of stories that God's power doesn't stop. That his power isn't contained in just healing. That there's no timeline where it's too late for God to fix something or to heal or to make right. In our own lives, there's maybe times where we have to come to that reality of, well, God, it seems like the train has left the station. I think it's beyond repair. If we think that, we're limiting what God can do. The story reminds me of that, that there's nothing too hard for God. Isn't that, again, what God said in Genesis 18 about Sarah having a child at, I think, what, 90 years old? Is anything impossible or anything too hard for God? He demonstrates his power to create, his power to control the universe, to guide nations, and to personally interact and intervene in our lives in a very personal way. That's what the Bible is full of, stories about God's intervening with his power unlimited. And so point one for us to consider is our faith, is do we view his faith as unending, unlimited, omnipotent? And as hard as that is to sometimes grasp, I think that's the easiest of the three we're going to talk about today. So I'm really setting this up here, right? This is the easiest of the three, to view him as all-powerful. Because the next two even get a little bit harder. Because remember back in Daniel 3, we won't go there, but those three men said God is able. But if not, if he chooses not to, let it be known we still won't worship you. And that's what leads us to the second point. That, well, if not, but if not, to say God can, but if he doesn't, I still believe. Right, that's what these men were demonstrating. Not a lack of faith in his power, but to recognize God chooses to use that power in his own times and plans. But if not, and that's where we have to have faith in the second point, in God's wisdom. That we have to boldly trust that he can deliver, but there's times where he will choose not to. That he'll choose to do it in his own way. That God could have chosen to let these three men be thrown into the fire, be killed, and come up in the resurrection. Right, that was God's prerogative. And again, that wouldn't have changed God's plan if he chose to do that. And yet, he chose not to. But these men proclaimed, if God chooses that, we accept that reality. And that's a hard point to get in our faith with God. To accept he can, but he might not. Faith in his wisdom. Faith in his knowledge. It's one thing to know that God has the power to save. It's another to accept that he withholds that power for reasons that we don't always understand. They're professing that God can deliver. He has that power. But also that's his prerogative through his wisdom to choose when to use that power. Sometimes he'll keep us from being thrown in the fire, and other times he may not. No, it's a hard reality for each of us to grapple with at times. No, when I was a school teacher, one thing we had to do every day before the kids came into classrooms, we had to write a daily objective. So on the board, I'd write, you know, today the kids, or I wouldn't say the kids, because we were told to do it in an I statement. So I'd write it as an I statement for the kids, so they'd say, today I'll be able to, you know, accurately write the valence electrons for an atom. And when the kids left after my period, they would know whether they did what they were supposed to do and learned what they were supposed to learn by reading that statement and say, can I do this? If the answer is yes, well then, as a teacher, I did what I was supposed to do, and the kids got it. And oftentimes we do what we'd call an exit ticket. And so as the kids were leaving, it was like a 30-second quiz. And the quiz would be on that statement, that daily objective. So it's a quick way as a teacher to know, okay, did the kids learn what I hope they learned today? And some days it'd be great, right? All the kids could pass the exit ticket, and I know, okay, they can do what I wanted them to learn today. The lesson worked. Then other days, I'd get these exit tickets, And I'd think, wow, they did not learn anything that I thought they were going to learn. And I could blame them, but the reality is I probably didn't have a great lesson plan that day. Something didn't go the way I planned it to go. Right? Lesson plans don't always go according to plan. There are times when science experiments were supposed to mix these chemicals and this was going to happen, and it didn't always happen. Or times it happened too much, where a beaker blew up. You know, that happened in my classroom sometimes too. And the kids found that part more exciting. When something over happened, that's when they're excited. But my point is, as humans, right, we have daily objectives, goals. And as humans, though, those goals, those objectives don't always work like we expect. But the other side of this is that God also works kind of in a similar way. That God has objectives for us, plans for our life. But what's different between us and him, if he has a plan, it's not because he can't make it happen, right? His lesson plan's not going to flop. Now, as humans, we can ignore his lesson plan and mess it up. But at the end of the day, God's lesson plans are going to be perfect. So when he chooses to withhold a decision, when he chooses to heal or not heal, it's because within his plan, he knows the outcome of where he wants it to go. That's something for us as humans, it's hard to grapple with that reality, though. Because we see it and how we see it and how it should be. And God says, I'm not seeing it quite the same way. And that's where we have challenges. Our desired outcomes aren't always the ones that God has in mind. And so we struggle with where things go. When God says this is going to happen this way, it always works out that way. Because he's all-powerful, and nothing is beyond his wisdom. So it's going to happen the way he plans. It's always going to get done perfectly according to his will. We kind of read that in Romans and other places today. So it comes down to us being able to say, God, you know best. You know how this should play out, even if it's not what makes sense to me, or what I hope, or what I think it should be. That you're going to handle it in a way that you know is best, even when it's not what I hope and think is best. As humans, we often have ideas of how things should go. And at times, it's not always the same plans that God has about how things should go. Well, go with me over to the book of Isaiah, Isaiah 55. When I find myself in these situations, this is often where I go to. Isaiah 55. Verses 8 and 9. Isaiah 55, 8 and 9 says, For my thoughts are not your thoughts, nor are my ways your ways, says the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. When I'm struggling, this is often where I go, and I just read this and be reminded that in my head it should have went with this plan, but God has chosen another plan. And I can struggle with that and see all the reasons why my way made sense and God's way doesn't make sense. And yet, the reality is we just can't always see his ways. We can't grasp the level of where God is working. I equate it to being a kid at times. We think about this analogy of sometimes as kids, we have these ideas of what's going to be best or what should be good. I remember, I think I was 17. I had this idea, you know, I should drive 2,000 miles to go see a friend for like a day, get like a half a night's sleep, and then drive, you know, 2,000 miles back. Tell my dad, you know, I'm going to do this to see a friend. My dad said, no, that's a bad idea. And I think, no, it's a great idea. Like, I get to see a friend. What could go wrong? Right? Driving 2,000 miles, not sleeping, like, perfect plan. And in my 17, 18-year-old mind, it made sense. And yet, my dad, in his wisdom, probably being in the same boat at some point in his own life, knew, no, this doesn't make sense. And I think, what could go wrong? And he says, a lot of things could go wrong. And if we think about that with our relationship with God, we often see it in such narrow terms, right? And we can say, yeah, obviously our ideas aren't always so crazy as that, but the gap between my understanding to my dad's and our understanding to God's is quite a gulf, beyond what we can think and comprehend at times. And so for us, we struggle with this reality and say, well, God, this doesn't seem to make sense. My thoughts seem to be good. My plans, how you should fix this, makes sense. And he says, no, at the end of the day, you don't see the whole picture. You don't see how it's going to work. And thankfully, at times in our life, later we see the picture. And things work out in a way that we never would have imagined. We say, okay, God, now I see this better picture and plan that you had that I had no grasp on, of why you made this go this way, or why this didn't work out because you had something better in plan, or why this was. And we start to see glimpses of those things. But those other times where in this physical life, we really never get to see it. Of asking God, why did you allow this sickness? Why did you allow this person to die or suffer so long? Or why did that miscarriage happen? Or why did this or that, right? There's sometimes we're never going to get the answer, the picture. And those things are real and they hurt. And we don't always get the why. Those are the hard things to grasp and come to terms with God. I believe you have unlimited power. So why didn't you intervene at this time? Why didn't you walk through the flames like you did with those guys and fix it? And we come to the answer of just like those men said, but if not, I still trust God. And that's where it's not just faith in his power, but faith in his wisdom and his decision making comes in. Right? As I was working on this sermon this past week, you know, kind of led me here because of the challenges both in this congregation and Mansfield. Right? Wednesday we got the message of Rick Shaby's death. Thursday, we're at Becky Giesler's funeral at 46 years old. And all these challenges, I feel like we've had a tough time in that sense since we've moved here. And Wednesday happened to also be the four-year anniversary of my dad's death. And so all these things come, and we have these questions of, well, God, why did this go the way it did? Or why didn't it go a different way? You know, at 51, why did my dad die? Right? We have these questions that we ask. We don't always get these answers. And we have to trust that, well, God, your ways are higher than mine. So I trust there's some reason for it beyond what we can see and understand. And sometimes that's all we're left with. We don't always get the why, and yet it leads us to say we have to trust in the process. It's not enough to just trust his power. We have to trust his wisdom of what he chooses to do or not do. And what's interesting, that can sound like a pretty hollow relationship at times. But it's a very, I guess as I say it, a very kind of technical idea of, well, we trust his power, we trust his wisdom. And it sounds kind of cold. And in some ways, if that's all we had, I think it would be cold and it would be challenging. Because there's times in my life where that's been a hard point to come to. And that's where I think the third point that we come to today is what we often have to rest on. Go with me to 2 Corinthians chapter 12 as we think about this third element. 2 Corinthians chapter 12. The Apostle Paul was dealing with some health challenges and he kept praying to God for healing. In 2 Corinthians 12, Paul says, concerning this thing, I pleaded with the Lord three times that he might depart, that it might depart from me. And God said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. It's an interesting phrase. He says, I kept asking God for healing. And what was God's response? And essentially, he said, no. He said, my grace. The word grace is powerful, right? It means favor or love. Sometimes it's translated loving kindness. My grace is sufficient for you. So trust in my love for you that I'm allowing this for a reason. He didn't say, well, I don't have the power to fix it, or in my wisdom, it just doesn't make sense. No, he uses the phrase, my grace is sufficient for you. Sometimes in our relationship with God and our trust and faith in him, what we have to fall back on is his grace and his love for us. That we trust that, even if we don't understand his wisdom and his decisions, we trust his love for us and know that that's sometimes all that we have. Now, go with me back to the book of Daniel again. Daniel chapter 2 this time. In Daniel 2, before we get the story of the fiery furnace, we get the story of Daniel's friends being threatened to be killed again. In the book of Daniel, you know, these guys go through three stories of about to be killed in this small book. And each time they trust in God. So Daniel 3, remember Nebuchadnezzar has this dream and he wants his wise men to tell him what the dream is. But he won't even tell them the dream. He said, to know you're really telling the truth, you have to tell me the dream and what it means. Which if you're not, you know, told by God what it is, you have no hope. So these guys are all about to be killed. But notice what Daniel does when he hears about this, because him and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are in this group of wise men who are going to be killed. And in Daniel 2, sorry, I lost my place here, in verse 16. It says, so Daniel went in and asked the king to give him time that he might tell the king the interpretation. Then Daniel went to his house and made the decision known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. You know, these are three different names with the same three guys, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These are their Hebrew names. In Daniel 3, they're called by their Babylonian names. But the same three guys we read about before. So Daniel and these three men know about this. It says that they might seek mercies from the God of heaven concerning this secret, so that Daniel and his companions might not perish with the rest of the wise men. Notice, it doesn't say they sought God's wisdom, sought God's power. So they went and prayed and sought God's mercies, God's favor, God's love for them. So God, we know you love us, so we're asking for your help. Similar to God's response to Paul there in 2 Corinthians, my mercy or my grace is sufficient for you. So it says they sought God's mercies, God's favor on them. Now the secret may be known. And God reveals the secret to Daniel. And then notice Daniel's prayer in response in verse 20. So Daniel answered and said, blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his. Notice right away he proclaims God's omnipotence, omniscience, wisdom and might are his. He changes the times and the seasons and removes kings and raises up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and secret things. He knows what is in the darkness, and light dwells with him. I thank you and praise you, O God of my fathers, for you have given me wisdom and might, and have now made known to me what we ask of you, for you have made known to us the king's demand. And so Daniel praises God's wisdom, praises God's might. But remember how this all began, that they might seek mercies from the God of heaven. They recognize that when we have nothing else to fall back on, we fall back on God's love, God's mercy, and his grace for us. Then in this book full of global events, they sought God's mercy. They sought God's love for them, because that's the ultimate faith that we have, is to have a faith in God's unending love for us. When nothing else is working, when his ways are so far beyond our ways that we can't seem to grasp why he's doing what he's doing, this is what I've found to fall back on. The only thing I've found that we trust in God's love for us. That I have faith that God's love for me is beyond what I can understand. So if he's allowing it, it's not just some cold, calculated decision in his perfect mind to say, this makes sense. No, God also loves me. And so my faith is rooted in his love for me, not just his wisdom, but that he loves me beyond what I can understand. So if he allows this, it's still out of his love. And it's hard to understand, but sometimes that's all we have to fall back on. Go with me to 1 John as we think about this. 1 John 4 and verse 8. We have faith that God's all-loving. 1 John 4. I'll pick it up in verse 7. It says, "Beloved, let us love one another, for love is of God." So it begins by saying love is of God. It's a part of who he is. But then he continues, "And everyone who loves is born of God and knows God. He who does not love does not know God, for God is love." That word is a verb like to be. So it says this is who he is. It's his nature, his character. It defines God. Right? God is defined by love. And so we don't have a lot of understanding of what he's doing, why he's doing it, or why he's not doing something. This is what we have to fall back on. That God, you are love. It's who you are. So when I'm struggling with understanding, when I'm struggling with grasping the pain that we're in or the struggles that we're going through, I trust that you love me. I have faith in your unending love for me, even more than your power or your wisdom. I have faith that you love me, and that's unending. And we hold on to that, and sometimes that's all we have to hold on to. It gets us through when the wisdom and the might aren't going in the way that we hope that it would. You know, another book that was written similar to Daniel's time is the book of Jeremiah. Right, Jeremiah was prophesying of what was going to happen when Jerusalem was going to be ransacked and taken away. But then in the middle of it, Jeremiah prophesies that the people will get to go back. That in God's love for them, he's going to bring them back even through the tough times. Go with me to the book of Jeremiah chapter 29. We'll see God's love woven through even some of the hardest times in life. Jeremiah 29. So in let's go to verse 10. Jeremiah 29:10. "For thus says the Lord, after 70 years are completed at Babylon, I will visit you and perform my good word towards you and cause you to return to this place. For I know the thoughts that I think towards you, says the Lord, thoughts of peace and not of evil, to give you a future and a hope. Then you will call upon me and go and pray to me, and I will listen to you, and you will seek me and find me when you search for me with all of your heart." Right, this reminds us of God's love and heart for these people that had rebelled and rejected him, and they were punished. And yet God says, "My plans for you are these things of beauty, of peace and love, future and a hope, not evil." And so when our life seems like it's spiraling and his power is not being used for the ways we think it should fix these things, this is where we go. "God, your thoughts are not evil towards me." Even if it seems like things are a wreck, we come back here and be reminded that his love for us is about giving us a future and a hope. Even if we don't see how it's working out, don't even see why this is the way it's going to go, we fall back on that reality that his love for us carries us through these tough times. His love for us is why he makes every decision that he does. Just as a parent, that when they say no to something or they guide a child, but a good parent does it because they know what's best for their kid, even when their kid doesn't see it. That in his perfect love, his perfect wisdom, and his complete power, he makes decisions that we can't comprehend how they're best, how they're for our future and our hope. But it's true that every time it's what's best, even when we can't see it. And we fall back on his love for us to know that that's what's best. Now, I mentioned briefly, I've shared this a couple times since we've been here, about losing my dad. At 31 years old, to lose my dad is not something I ever expected, right? We lived in California, so it's the longest I'd ever gone without seeing him, 6 months. And God and I had a lot of conversations about why he would allow that. And I don't have all the answers for sure, but one thing I have learned is that I can empathize with people in a way that I never could before. And as a pastor, it's part of something that I've learned is really valuable as we've gone through difficult, challenging times in life, is that I didn't know pain and loss in quite the same way that I do now. And so to be able to relate and understand some of these things, it's difficult. Definitely painful, and yet I think it's made me grow in a way that I wouldn't have wanted, wouldn't have asked for, didn't know that I needed. And yet, maybe in God's wisdom, he knew that's what I needed. As a human, as a pastor, as a parent, empathy that we don't always naturally have other times. And so we trust his perfect wisdom, his perfect love, his perfect power. Now, I read a question one time of, does God mess up? It's a question that kind of got stuck in my mind at times. Does God mess up? And I think we naturally probably say, no, God doesn't mess up, right? And yet, when you really doubt God's decision, in some ways that's what we're saying. Well, God, you should have done it a different way. You could have fixed this a different way than what you did. God, I think I know better. Well, we wouldn't say that to God, but in some ways that's kind of what we allude to. Now, hear me out. It doesn't mean we can't ask why. I've asked God why a lot of times. But there's a difference in asking why and letting it lead us to doubt in God's goodness and his love and his wisdom. I think God's okay with us asking why. There's a lot of people in the Bible that ask God why for a lot of things. Sometimes they get answers, sometimes they don't. But what we can't let it do is lead us to doubt. Now go with me to Luke as we start wrapping up here and think about this concept of doubt. That one person who had to have no doubt in God, the Father, was Jesus Christ. Think about when he chose to give up being God, gave up eternal life, he had to have no doubt that God the Father would return to him the glory that he had. But we've never had to give up anything close to giving up eternal life. Imagine the trust, the faith in the Father that he had, that, Father, you love me so much that when I give up being God, living forever, that you're going to give it back to me. Opposed to thinking, well, God could just say, well, now I'm the only God, right? He had that option, and yet Jesus Christ had to love and trust God the Father enough, have enough faith in him and who he was, that he knew he could give it up and be given it back once again. I think that's an interesting concept to think about, of even the faith that Jesus Christ had in the Father, be willing to give up the most important thing that he had. So we go to Luke 18 and verse 1. You know, oftentimes a parable is not explained until later, but this time Christ gives the explanation right away, or at least Luke does in his writing. It says, then he spoke a parable to them, that men always ought to pray and not lose heart. So he says, this is what the parable is about. Always praying, not losing heart. But that's what happens sometimes when our faith gets questioned. That's where we find ourselves, of stop praying, and we lose heart. So he says, there's a certain city, a judge who did not fear God nor regard man. Now there's a widow in that city, and she came to him saying, get justice for me from my adversary. And he would not for a while. But afterward he said within himself, though I do not fear God nor regard man, yet because this widow troubles me, I will avenge her, lest by her continual coming she weary me. Seems like a funny story in some ways. It says, when the Lord said, hear what the unjust judge said, and shall God not avenge his own elect who cry out day and night to him, though he bears long with them? I tell you that he will avenge them speedily. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, will he really find faith on the earth? And so in this parable, again, as he begins in verse 1, it's a story about not losing heart, not stopping because we don't get the answer we want. Maybe the answer that God gives is no, or not right now. Or as he said to Paul, my grace is sufficient for you. And yet he says, don't let that make you stop or lose heart. As if God doesn't hear you, as if God doesn't love you and care about you. That isn't what that answer means. God loves you, but he's saying this isn't what's best for what I see and know. It's a hard reality for us to find ourselves in, but that's where we go. Do we fall back on his love for us, even when nothing else is making sense? I want to conclude back in the book of Jeremiah one last time. Jeremiah 32, verse 17. Then we'll see the faith, all three of these elements discussed in this short verse here. Jeremiah 32, verse 17. Find Jeremiah interesting because he was prophesying at a pretty terrible time. The nation was a mess. They're about to be conquered. All these terrible things going on. And Jeremiah was pretty emotional about it. He's sometimes nicknamed the weeping prophet because of the emotion we see from him. But notice the faith that we see in him as well. Jeremiah 32 and verse 17. He says, ah, Lord God, behold, you have made the heavens and the earth by your great power and outstretched arm. How does he begin? God, you're omnipotent. Your great power and outstretched arm. There's nothing too hard for you. Right? Nothing too hard. You show loving kindness to thousands and repay the iniquity of the fathers into the bosom of their children after them. So he dives into his loving kindness, his love, saying, God, you're just in your love. And then he continues, the great, the mighty God, whose name is the Lord of hosts. You're great in counsel and might in work. So it goes back to these three elements, his power, his counsel, his loving kindness. We're kind of woven through this section. Jeremiah's writing to this, even in all the terrible things going on in his country, his people, and he knows that God is a God of love, of wisdom, and of power. And we've all been there at times where our faith is challenged, where we wait and trust and wait more. We suffer and don't see God's power in the way that we hope. But the reality is God is omnipotent, that his power is unending globally and personally. And that God is omniscient, that his wisdom and knowledge extends beyond what we can see and understand as humans. And that his unfailing love and his benevolence, there's nothing beyond his love for us. That his love for us is unending, and that he works those three things together to help us build faith in his power, his love, and his wisdom.